Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today, our program will feature the Senior Vice President of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Dr. John R. Lumpkin. His talk, titled Health Reform Starts Now, addresses issues with healthcare and healthcare reform, and focuses on local community organizations' roles in improving healthcare. Dr. Lumpkin served for 12 years as the Director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. He's been the chairman of the National Committee on Vital and Health Statistics, the advisory committee to the director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the National Institute of Medicine's Committee on Assuring the Health of the Public in the 21st Century. Dr. Lumpkin spoke recently in Augusta before the Maine Health Access Foundation, a group whose mission is to promote affordable and timely access to comprehensive quality health care and improve the health of Maine residents. This program will be available online at mpbn.net, where you can stream it or download it as a podcast and take it with you. Look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for Audio On Demand, where you'll find this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. Another service made possible by member support. Introducing the speaker is Dr. Wendy Wolf, President and CEO of the Maine Health Access Foundation.
I'd like to welcome you all to the luncheon today, and before I introduce Dr. Lumpkin, I want to acknowledge that April 2010 is a big month for the Maine Health Access Foundation. 10 years ago, the Maine Superior Court actually legally incorporated the foundation, and so this month is the kickoff of celebrating our 10th year of being here in Maine, and it has been a wonderful decade. Oh, thank you. You can leave the presents and the cake and the card in the back and things like that. It's been actually great 10 years to work on behalf of Maine people and trying to really expand access to high-quality health care for every person in Maine, and I must say it's been the most rewarding job that I think I've had in my career to head up this foundation and the important work that it does. It's a distinct honor to introduce one of my colleagues in philanthropy. Dr. Lumpkin comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, where he serves as a senior vice president and the director of the healthcare group at this large national foundation. Before he went into philanthropy in 2003, he served as the first African-American director of the Illinois Department of Public Health for 12 years. He has a number of appointments, prestigious awards, and honors. They're all summarized in your program in his very extensive biography. But let me note that he's a member of the Institute of Medicine, of the National Academies. He's also a fellow of the American College of Emergency Physicians and the American College of Medical Informatics, something near and dear to my heart. He has also been chairman of the National Committee on Vital and Health Statistics, and this is very important to him given his background in public health, and he served on the boards of directors for the Public Health Foundation, the National Quality Forum, and as speaker and board of directors member for the American College of Emergency Physicians. I do think it's very important when people are in health philanthropy that our work is really informed by individuals who not only can see sort of the broad opportunities and policy issues, but really marry that to what has to happen on the ground, as we say, in the trenches, and ground all that work in the reality of how we deliver health care and ensure that we're really meeting the needs of our patients across diverse communities, rural and urban settings, and working with individuals coming from diverse cultures whose approach to our healthcare system may be different than ours. Dr. Lumpkin has really provided incredible conceptionary vision to some of the most important initiatives that the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is promoting, including the important Aligning Forces for Quality work that Maine is a participant in. Today, we are going to hear more about the leadership of the foundation and the important work that they are focusing on. And I'd like you to join me in welcoming Dr. Lumpkin to the podium.
Thank you for that kind introduction. I'm honored to have the opportunity to come to Maine again and to speak here today, both to Quality Counts Conference and to the trustees for the Maine Health Access Foundation, who will be meeting a little bit later today. And they're seating at some of the tables right in front. A lot has happened since I accepted the invitation to speak here. After what has been the most bitter and partisan discussion I've ever witnessed, the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act has become the law of the land. So whether you were for it or against it, it will have an impact on our work to improve the quality of care for all Americans. In fact, with tens of millions more Americans getting access to health care insurance, their current trends of spiraling costs, underuse, overuse, and misuse cannot be sustained. This meeting and its topics couldn't be timelier. It is hard to think of a place to talk about the impacts of health reform other than doing it in Maine. The very fact that you have hundreds of people attending a conference entitled Transforming Health and Healthcare in Maine's Communities speaks volumes about you and your state. Now, there used to be a saying in presidential politics that goes, as Maine goes, so goes the nation. Now, that saying lost a little bit of currency in the 1960s when the state changed its voting laws to actually vote when everybody else did, instead of in September. But as I stand before you half a century later, I can't help but feel that it may be time to revive this old saying, but in a new context. I'm speaking, of course, about meaning reform of the healthcare system to deliver high-quality, effective, and efficient healthcare services. This state, thanks to many of you in this room, has been blazing trails not only towards stable, affordable coverage of your citizens, but also towards a high-value healthcare system. And your path-breaking efforts have inspired and formed the efforts of reformers across the country. I know this because I have a front-row seat, thanks to the Aligning Forces for Quality program at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. It is our signature program to lift the quality of healthcare in selected communities across the country and provide models for national reform. Given your legacy, it's no surprise that the foundation and Maine found each other when we conducted a national competition for regional collaboratives to join Aligning Forces for Quality. Today, Maine is one of 17 communities, living laboratories of reform that make up Aligning Forces for Quality. Together, these 17 communities represent over 34 million people and over 650 hospitals. Now, no two of these communities are alike. They range from tiny Humboldt County up in California near Eureka, if you know where that is. I don't actually either. To entire states like Minnesota, Wisconsin, and here in Maine. From communities that had never tried any of these strategies to regions with significant amount of experience, like here in Maine. And just look around you to see what we saw. Your ability to collaborate is a real strength, as each community alliance is uniting those who get care, who give care, and pay for care to work together towards some common fundamental objectives that lead to better quality care. While Quality Counts is the driving force behind Aligning Forces and initiative in Maine, it operates as part of a collaborative trio. Quality Counts Executive Director Lisa Letourneau, along with Aligning Forces Project Director Ted Rooney and his team, work closely with the Maine Health Management Coalition and its CEO, Elizabeth Mitchell, as well as the Maine Quality Forum and its director, Josh Cutler. As many of you know, a central feature of our Aligning Forces program is measuring and reporting on the quality of healthcare provided by doctors and hospitals. But that's not the end of the story. Performance measurement and public reporting is necessary, but not sufficient by itself to achieve fundamental change. As Don Berwick says, quoting a Chinese proverb, or maybe it's an African proverb, I can't quite remember, but what it says is, you don't fatten a pig by weighing it repeatedly. Measurement is a tool. It's not a goal or an outcome. So this information is only as good as its use. First, it must be used to help providers improve the quality of their care. And second, it must be used to help payers and consumers make better choices. Maine has been ahead of the national curve on both these fronts. Indeed, the Pathways to Excellence program operated by the Maine Health Management Coalition was in the business of measuring and reporting on quality years before they joined Aligning Forces for Quality in 2007. And as for getting information into the hands of users, your collaborative trio has worked closely with the State Health Employee Health Commission and its director, Frank Johnson, in its continuing efforts to get state employees to make choices based on the coalition's quality criteria. And the Care Enough to Compare campaign, which has attracted partners like Maine's People's Alliance and the state chapter of AARP, is another example. On the quality improvement front, nurses from four Maine hospitals are engaged in Aligning Forces Hospital Quality Improvement Initiative called Transforming Care at the Bedside. This initiative helps frontline healthcare staff members lead quality improvement efforts that help eliminate infection rates and other preventable health problems. Think about that as sort of a novel idea, actually letting the people involved in giving the care come up with ideas about how to make it better. The Maine team is also doing exemplary work in the pilot project to implement the medical home concept to help primary care practices improve care and then reward them for doing that. The 26 practices in this pilot are working together with payers to redesign their practices. They have committed to meeting nationally recognized standards, but most importantly, major private payers and MaineCare have been committed to alternative payment schemes that recognize the value of these new models. The ultimate goal of this initiative is to sustain and revitalize primary care, both to improve health outcomes and to reduce costs. That's cutting-edge work. And we are delighted to recently have awarded Maine two grants to support these efforts on top of our general support for Aligning Forces for Quality. Now, your record of innovation extends well beyond Aligning Forces partnership to Derigo's Health's early efforts to cover the under and uninsured, to your national leadership on how tobacco settlement monies have been utilized, to the innovative work of Healthy Maine partnerships in creating public health districts, to your efforts to connect the public health and healthcare systems so you can begin to tackle the social determinants of health. Of course, not everything that you've touched has turned to gold. Of course, it never does. But in your many, many successes, you have learned an invaluable lesson, that change is not only about embracing the new, it is also about letting go of the old. While so many others have thrown up their hands in disgust at a system that costs too much and covers too few, you have refused to sit still. In fact, the work that you've done in Maine reminds me of what Franklin Delano Roosevelt said America needed during the depths of the Great Depression. He said, "The country demands bold, persistent experimentation. It is common sense to take a method and try it. If it fails, admit it. But above all else, then go out and try something else." And that you have. And because of that, you have much to celebrate. But I'm also here to tell you that your work has only just begun. For those of us who care about improving health and healthcare, this is a pivotal moment. Indeed, it is a pivotal moment for our country. The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act of 2010 will touch everyone who gets care, pays for care, provides care, some sooner, some later, some with known consequences, and for others, the full impact will not be known for years. But there is one thing that you can be certain of. Your quest to expand access to care, to get greater value for your healthcare dollars, and to improve the health of every citizen are no longer the province of just a few pioneers like here in Maine. They are about to become the work of this entire nation. The most talked about features of the new law touch on the first quest, improving access to care. This year, it allows young Americans to stay under parents' plans until the age of 27. It bans exclusion of pre-existing conditions for children and eliminates lifetime gaps. And it mandates first dollar coverage for preventive services. Additional provisions come into effect in 2014, and I don't know about you, but I personally believe that this law will have an impact upon me and my children's lives. Both my children have pre-existing conditions. And come 2014, they will not be excluded from getting insurance in the private market. In 2014, it requires everyone to have health care insurance, and it opens Medicaid to more of the working poor and children, and it creates subsidies to help the working poor buy insurance. At the same time that this law expands coverage, it also recognized the need to bend the curve down of health care costs. These costs are rising at an alarming rate. At our present pace, unless something changes, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that by 2050, our nation's spending on health care will be 30% of gross domestic product. And Medicare and Medicaid will represent 43% of the total federal budget, leaving little room for things like education and other kinds of social programs. These sobering facts mandate that we move further along the path towards a system that embraces value than we have ever done before. And that is the second quest. And we cannot do that without changing the toxic payment system that rewards volume and overuse and devalues quality of care and good outcomes. The new law provides some important first steps. It rewards Medicare providers who deliver care more efficiently. It rewards physicians who provide quality care at lower cost to Medicare patients, and it penalizes providers who deliver subpar care. All of these are important steps, but they don't go far enough. I think that it is time for communities to take the initiative and to begin the experimentation that can drive policy at the national level. Individual markets through agreements of those who pay for care, both in the public and the private sector, of those who give care and those who get the care, need to work together to implement payment experimentation. Those markets can be a metropolitan area, they can be communities, or they can be a state like Maine. Aligning Forces for Quality communities have a unique opportunity to lead the nation in finding solutions for this critical challenge, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is looking forward to working with you as you do so. So let's turn now to the third quest, improving the health of every citizen. 100 years ago, the life expectancy in this nation was 49 years, and we spent about 4 to 6% of gross domestic product on health care. By 1960, life expectancy had increased to 69 years, probably the single largest increase in life expectancy for humans since proto-humans determined that saber-toothed tigers didn't make good house pets. But in 1960, we still only spent 4 to 6% of GDP on health care. And all of this change, this dramatic increase, occurred before we had things like antibiotics and high-tech medicine. This increase in life expectancy was due to basic public health interventions like good sanitation, improved nutrition, and immunizations. Since the 1960s, the focus of spending has shifted from prevention to high-tech treatment of diseases. Healthcare expenditures have mushroomed to go past 17% of GDP, and paradoxically, spending for prevention has dropped to just 4% of the health dollar. Now, we all know that Americans are not as healthy as they could be or should be. But despite the fact that we spend far more than any other nation on health care, the country-by-country health listings that you heard today from Julie and how you're going to use them in Maine are going to show, in many instances, wide disparities that exist even in a state like Maine. And we know that getting more people health coverage by itself will not improve the overall health status. And we also know that improving the value we get for the money we spend won't do all of it either. Good health is about a lot more than just getting high-quality health care. Health happens where we live, where we learn, where we work, and where we play. And the last time I checked, most of that happens outside of the doctor's office. So improving health overall requires a partnership between healthcare providers, public health, communities, and the people who live in them. All of them working together to prevent disease and promote healthier lifestyles. This new law makes some important strides in that direction also. It establishes a funding mechanism that guarantees at least $15 billion to give traction to efforts to help communities reduce chronic diseases and health disparities, to expand the public health workforce, to promote prevention and wellness through national campaigns. And here's one that seemed to me to have been a no-brainer. It now provides that Medicaid coverage is available for smoking cessation. It funds exercise, smoking cessation and nutrition education for all covered populations, and it requires nutrition information to be posted at chain restaurants and vending machine food. Now, you're fortunate in Maine to have a strong foundation for data-driven efforts to address these population health issues. Thanks much to your recent actions to form a new statewide public health system that addresses health issues across the state and in every community. This conference is another important step. It helps build the bridges between the public health community and the healthcare delivery community, and that is critical to improve the health of this state and the nation. In sum, while the new law propels our healthcare system in a new direction, it is only a start. The challenge now is to continue to build on your history of implementing quality improvement, and the hard work starts now. At the end of the day, improving our healthcare is not a national problem. It is a local problem. It is Maine's problem, it's Lincoln County's problem, and it's Franklin County's problem. So if we're to succeed in the triple quest of improving access to care, driving to high-quality, high-value health care, and improving overall health, we must change the facts on the ground, one community at a time. And that is why your work today and your work here in Maine is so important, and why you must push forward to continuing to improve the quality of both health and health care here in Maine. Now, I'd like to leave you with one last thought. This work is about people. People and the health of people of Maine and the country. This work is about solving problems that leaves no one happy, not the family feeling injury or illness that could wipe out their savings or throw them into bankruptcy, not the small business owner who wants to do the right thing by their employees and in many cases themselves, but can't pay for insurance and keep their business afloat, and not the provider who's trying to do their best for their patient. My wife is an obstetrician-gynecologist. She left her practice almost 10 years ago out of frustration with the way that care was delivered in the hospital in which she practiced. At one point, she had told me that she hadn't had a patient admitted to the hospital that didn't have a medical error for the last 6 months. She felt overwhelmed by the economics that forced her to see more patients in less time. And when the offer came to work for the Attorney General in Illinois, Jim Ryan, she leapt at that offer. But it was the conversations that she told me about in the doctor's lounge that made me see how bad things had really gotten. No one tried to talk her out of leaving her practice. Rather, they all lamented the fact that they couldn't figure out how to do it themselves. For my wife and too many of the physicians who practice, the joy of medicine has been replaced with the grind. Too many have moved from the thrill of private practice to the isolation and sense of oppression. Yet in this work that we do, there is a ray of hope. Not too long ago, Dr. Tracy Hofeditz, who's a Lakewood, Colorado doctor, was talking to some of the staff who are working with one of our programs that goes out and works with physicians and helps them adopt quality improvement in their offices. And she marveled after a few months in the program. She said, "I was considering leaving the profession. Now I have rediscovered the joy of practicing medicine. Working in an environment where help is available and the practice is refocused on caring for the patients and not on making the monthly payroll is one way to bring the joy back into medicine. And wouldn't that be a wonderful thing for caregivers and the patients whose health depends on them?" And that is the essence of the work that you do here. You are providing hope. Hope in a better way of getting care, paying for care, and providing care. In the December article in the New Yorker magazine, Atul Gawande wrote, "Transforming healthcare everywhere starts with transforming it somewhere. And you can make that somewhere right here. No law can do what you can do. The room is brimming with talent and dedication. Just look around you. You understand the need to embrace the future and let go of the past. You understand the need to experiment, and if that fails, to experiment again. So don't stop. It is my genuine hope that in a few years, I can return to Maine and tell you, as Maine went in healthcare, so went the nation." Thank you. Sure, we have time for a few questions. There are a couple of microphones.
One on either side here.
If there are any questions?
Good, there we go.
Good.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Lumpkin, for your being with us today and your remarks, and certainly for your ongoing support through the foundation. One of the major challenges that you noted in your list of several was reforming the very toxic payment system that contributes to a lot of what we face in terms of challenges today. What do you see in terms of, I mean, there are bits in the recent healthcare reform legislation. I know the foundation has had some interest in that. You're certainly supporting some work here in this state to do that. What do you see happening? How do we make that somewhere here? And how do we really make reform real when we're dealing with many different payers and many different situations? How would you suggest we start?
That's a good question. Next. Payment reform is really one of the most daunting challenges we face in healthcare. The problem is right now, at least before the health reform law, you had Medicare and many states, Medicaid, and they were kind of over here. And then you had the private payers, and of course they always get together because they don't try to compete or anything. And the real challenge is to get everybody in a market together to agree that we're going to try something differently. The payment system rewards certain efforts. So in my wife's practice, if she spent 15 or 20 minutes with a patient who came in who really, you know, didn't have a gynecological problem but had a family problem, and if she spent some time talking with that individual so that they could actually understand and get some help, she didn't get paid any more than if she had spent 2 minutes and said, "Gee, why don't you come back in 2 weeks if that's not better?" That's not the way a payment system ought to work. The important component about it, and I think the reason why Maine can be successful, because if you look at the people who are in the room, all the players are here, and they have to get together. You can't do it without the docs and the other primary care providers, because they need to have their voice heard about what's important to them. And you can't do it without the insurance payers who are trying to figure out how to, you know, go through a morass of bills and try to figure out which ones to pay. You need a health information infrastructure that can help you look at the data and figure out how best to allocate the resources. All those are separate pieces, but what you have to have, and probably the most important component of that, is will. Is there a desire to actually do things different in a way that will push towards high quality, effective care and improve the health of a community? If there were a magic bullet, you can bet that would have been in the bill. And what they did, because this bill is long on demonstration projects and short on solutions in relationship to payment reform, but what it does is it empowers communities to actually try to do something differently. And from that experimentation, you know, I just have a firm belief in the people of this country that there is enough ingenuity, and when you're in Maine, you can even say Yankee ingenuity, to find out what way will work, because if we don't, the alternatives are too draconian for us to think about. We're talking about price fixing, we're talking about price controls, and that helps no one.
Hi. Well, thank you for being here. I really appreciate your remarks. Maine has a long history of interesting place names, like Norway and Paris and Belgrade and China. And I'm seeing, as we evolve into the electronic medical record, that it's starting to feel like we're speaking Norwegian and Chinese and French in our different communities, and that we have a proliferation of EMRs that don't talk to each other, and that we're trading medical waste in trying to reduce EMRs and CAT scans for more medical waste in creating more and more EMRs that don't talk to each other. Given your interest in medical informatics, I'm wondering if the foundation is putting any efforts into at least statewide pilots of having a whole state or a whole grantee be on one EMR so that we can communicate much better and reduce waste that way.
I'm going to give you the simple answer to your question, which is no. But let me expound upon that. I don't think the answer is to have everybody be on the same EMR. Unfortunately, you'll find that vendors, I think of the example of Kaiser. When Kaiser in California merged with what is now Kaiser in Washington State, they both had a EMR from Epic, and the two systems didn't talk to each other. There are standards. You don't really need to have the same EMR. You just have to have everybody agree to use the same standards. And that first initial phase of that happened with HIPAA in 1996. I left the National Committee for Vital and Health Statistics in 2003, and there's still some of the rules that were required by Congress to have been implemented in a year that hadn't been implemented. So we need, first of all, we need standards. And then what I've learned since I was on that committee is that, okay, having a standard is good, but then there's an implementation guide. So we need to have common implementation guides. And then I learned that that was probably good enough. That gets you a little bit further, but then there are things that are rules of how they're implemented. And I think that's one of the things that this new law actually accomplishes, is it now gives authority to HHS to address not only the standards, the guidelines, but also the rules of implementation. And that ought to create an environment in which data can be exchanged. But you need one other thing, and it's something that you have the beginnings here in Maine, is you need to have a health information exchange. So the ability to interchange the data so that the data is available at the right time, at the right place, when the decisions are being made. My specialty training is in emergency medicine, and I used to always be blown away by the fact that I was in the emergency department looking at an EKG and making a decision about it. And then 2 or 3 days later, the cardiologist would read it, and that would be what was on the chart. We need to get the information and the knowledge that's involved in health decisions at the point in time in which those decisions are made. And that means through using electronic health records and sharing information between providers. So we get away from the concept of what Phil Lee used to say, that he always knew that data was a four-letter word. He just never knew it was spelled T-U-R-F. Well, thank you. Oh, wait.
No, I'm going to ask a question.
Okay, uh-oh.
I get to exercise my prerogative first. I want to ask your vision, since we have so much opportunity in health reform,
National health reform is also an opportunity to do something that's near and dear to our heart here in Maine, and that's really look at how we bring mental and behavioral health into alignment with physical health services. And actually, there are lots of leaders sitting in this room who are working extremely hard on this issue to really diminish the silos between these two elements of care, including our patient-centered medical home pilot is grappling with this. Could you see or help us understand from your perspective both what the opportunities are to push this forward at a national level and try and find opportunities within health reform to support this work and promulgate it more widely than just Maine?
Well, I think that there's some fundamental change began almost a year ago when the Children's Health Insurance Plan reauthorization was passed, and a component of that was mental health equity. That is an important component of a number of provisions in the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. It's based upon a fundamental understanding that I have that I don't really understand what the problem is. Because as far as I understand, our knowledge of mental illness is that the only reason why we separated from what we call physical illness is because we don't know as much as we thought we knew. That there are many organic bases for mental illness, and it's reflected in all the research that's going on as we begin to understand brain functioning, and that therefore it ought to be treated as what it is, which is a disease that people have, and to that extent, the fact that we have treated it so differently, I think, is not a positive reflection upon our health system. Within that context, the fact that now there are provisions in the bill that really look at increasing the funding, providing resources for training, I think we really do set the stage on the national level to begin to take a much more rational approach to the health, which is more than just the absence of illness, but a state of mental, physical, and emotional well-being as defined by the World Health Organization. And it's one that has to be addressed both in the healthcare treatment system, but also in the public health and the population health system.
Well, please join me in thanking Dr. Lumpkin for joining us here. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. John Lumpkin, Senior Vice President of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and a speech he gave recently in Augusta before the Maine Health Access Foundation. If you missed part of this Speaking in Maine program, you can hear it in its entirety online at mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you'll find this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, which can be streamed online or downloaded as a podcast, a service made possible by the support of MPBN members. Charles Beck is the executive producer of the program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm your producer and host, Gordon Fellis.